Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
It was called A Slice of Bread and Jam. Came out in 2015. And here's the author, Tommy Radigan. Thank you for taking the time.
That's fine, Al. How are you? And hello, America.
Well, I'm okay.
I've got a lot of friends out there, Al.
I'm okay. I don't know if America is, but but I am.
Well, it's no different from Britain, I'm sure.
Yeah, all sorts of issues nowadays. Now you wrote, like you were telling me beforehand, that this was going to be, it's part of a trilogy, really, and I know there's another book out and everything, and I've only been through the one. I found it quite enlightening in certain ways and very entertaining, and you are quite honest in your writing about things, like you don't hold back. What got you into telling your story?
Rather strange way of saying this, but it was my psychotherapist, nurse, that actually got me to do this. I've suffered with mental health problems, mental health issues, should I say, for the best part of my life. Basically, because of what happened during the period of my childhood. I don't deliberately reflect back on my childhood, but I have times when flashbacks, something happens and I get flashbacks to that childhood. And one of my ways of, you know, perhaps coming to terms with a lot of my problems was to, suggested by my psychiatric nurse, to perhaps think about writing about my life. And that really was what I decided to do in the end, was to write. But in doing so, and as you say, Al, my history as well, very honest and upfront, not looking for any self-pity or any pity. I've got no self-pity at all. I'm happy with the life that I've got, but I had to do this to be honest with myself. So when the reader reads these books, especially the other book, because it's very, very brutal, and it's, you know, the events and the topic and what goes on in that book, it's because I'm being brutal to myself and not really being brutal for the reader to read, because that's the whole point in... I've opened up the box that I've kept everything in, and rather than just visit now and again these demons, I've opened the box and I've let the demons out. And basically, you know, I'm feeling a lot better for it, to be quite honest with you. So, yeah, I'm sharing a journey, a long journey. And I'm sharing it with people, with readers, and anybody who wants to come on that journey. You can enjoy it, as you do, Apple.
This book, anyway, it tells a lot about when you were young and kind of the lifestyle you were living. And you weren't alone. There's a lot of kids probably in the same boat as you, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And so you were in the Hume area of Manchester, which was kind of not the best area, we say.
Well, Manchester during that period, I mean, it was 1963. But it would, looking back on it, it would take you back to the Victorian era, because a lot of Manchester hadn't changed from that period. And so, you know, you've got, you know, hundreds and thousands of houses there that are terraced houses, Victorian slums, if you like, especially here. I mean, a lot of it was all Victorian slums, gas lamps. Some places had the electricity in the main areas, you know, the city and whatever. But and these back streets, if you like, these are all lit by gas lamps. 1963, chimneys, night times in the winter, you know, spewing out the vile smoke and anything that anybody could burn to keep warm. So you can imagine what it was like. You know, smog, thick with smog sometimes. It was just a complete lot of wastelands and whatever, you know. So, and during that period of time, there was also, if you like, the rejuvenation of Hume, where they were knocking all these houses down, the slums and whatever. And of course, there was also empty buildings from the Second World War, which had been bombed, and Manchester still hadn't recovered fully, even in that era, from all this. So there's quite a lot of things going on. Absolutely children's playgrounds, all these places. Absolutely loved it. You know, running in and out of these bombed houses, scavenging, searching for anything, picking up the odd photograph and looking at it and wondering who had lived there. And, you know, I used to get all these sort of feelings out. You know, I don't know why I have these feelings, but I absolutely love being in these places. And just to feel a part of somebody else's life, which is a strange sort of thing when you're sitting in somebody else's ruined house and you're picking up, you're looking at a photograph and you're walking from empty room to empty room, dodging floorboards that are up and big holes in the floors that will, if you drop through, you'll drop through downstairs into another room. You know, it's brilliant.
Now, a lot of these houses were abandoned, and you know, did people not really have enough time to get out, or they just weren't given time before they were going to be destroyed? Like, how did that work for listeners?
Well, okay, basically what would happen is that the houses anyway were just left to run. You made the best out of them what you could. These were damp slums. Ours had no... the only place that we had electricity was down in the back room. The rest of it was all gas. And we couldn't afford gas. My parents couldn't afford gas because they had to go for their drinks. So we was basically in darkness most of the time. In the kitchen, you would have one sink, one cold tap. There was no hot water. There were no bathrooms. And you had an outside toilet. Now, there was 15 of us all together in that house. Can you imagine us queuing up to go to the toilet outside, especially in the winter?
Yeah.
Especially in the winter, Al, it was absolutely horrendous. So it was go where you can. You know, yeah. And we did. But yeah, so that's basically what it was like. And then people would be issued with notices that they had to leave. And these notices would give them a week or so to collect the belongings or whatever. It's all there in the book, you know, it explains everything in the book, and I'm sure that, you know, when you were listening to it, you were there and seeing what was going on, and, you know, it's there, and then people are out, sometimes it would take a year before you cleared the whole street. In our streets, I think there was only about five houses that were actually occupied. Perhaps six houses that were occupied. The rest were empty. And then once everybody... We loved it because we can go and smash the windows. You know, something for all the children to be able to lose at these places. And then once they were out, once everybody was out, in comes the ball and chain. I don't know if you know, the people in America know the expression, the ball and chain, because that's what it was a huge solid metal ball weighing tons on a chain, and they just swing it straight at the buildings. And that was it. You know, everything down.
Yeah. How, in an area like that, how was it policed? That's one thing I'm not sure about. Like, were there a lot of police, or did they sort of ignore it?
But the police were there. You saw, you know, plenty of police on the beat in the main streets, if you like. Mm-hmm. I very rarely saw a police officer, unless he came to my house to arrest my father or drag him out because he's, you know, assaulted somebody and get hold of him. But besides that, you know, I mean, we saw the police quite often. I mean, I saw the police, I've been to the police station about 187 times, I think, on the last count, a magistrate apparently says, because that's the amount of times, I suppose, arrested, if you like. It was for grand larceny, which sounds absolutely horrendous, but a grand larceny was either stealing sweets from a shop or stealing bicycles, which we normally did, just to get around.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah, the police were there, but I wouldn't say the police were there, you know, they were in the hot spots.
Right. You know, and I'm surprised your father seemed to be in the same sort of lifestyle, and in fact he used you on certain things, like when you pretended to be that lady's grandson and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, so you were in a way kind of brought up with that that lifestyle. Do what you have to survive.
That mentality, should I say, wasn't in my head, in the sense that I just did what I was told to do. It, for me, I didn't think I was doing anything wrong because I didn't have to stop and think, is this right or wrong? It was life. That's the way I was brought up, and so that was life. I didn't like. You know, when I look back at it, I'm not proud of, you know, that sort of thing. But it wasn't my fault. I just did what I was told to do. And I stole food to help my family. I begged for money on the streets to help my family. You know, everything I'd done was to help my family. It wasn't to help me. And of course, a lot of the money we collected helped my mother and father to get drunk. We were glad that we were out of the house until they came back and started beating up on us, or, you know, one of the other family, or even beating up on each other.
Yeah.
That's what it was like.
Yeah. It's a hard thing. Now, you were Irish descent, correct?
I was born in Ireland.
Right. And one thing that took me was when you were talking about, now this is something that surprised me, I didn't realize this was going on, about the signs on certain places saying no Irish blacks or dogs.
I think the dogs came first. No dogs, blacks, or Irishmen. I recall seeing lots of places with this on, and yet, you look at the building going on, and what do you see? You see black people on the building sites. You see Irish people on the building sites. As far as I see it, the Irish and the blacks built Manchester, or rebuilt Manchester, should I say. You know, and yet we're not allowed they weren't even allowed, or there was no vacancies to put these people up.
Yeah, that's I had no idea that went on. I think that's a surprise and something we learn over here. We had no idea. Now, when did they stop doing that? Like, when did they change that?
I'm not too sure, actually, because, you know, I mean, my father didn't care whether he was welcome anywhere anyway. He'd let himself in, and he'd sooner if he found out he wasn't welcome, because you know, he'd be thrown straight out. But, you know, I'm not sure. I should think perhaps the come towards the perhaps 1978, 80s. But I know that all this stems back, way back into the 20s, 30s, 40s. You know, my father was an MP in the military police during the Second World War. He served out in India. And so he did, he actually absconded from the Irish Army, because he was in the Irish Army. He was only 16 years of age at the time. And a lot of Irish men went AWOL from the Irish Army and joined the British Army to fight for this country. Yeah. And yet, you look around and you see these signs up. No dogs, because they were more important. No blacks, no Irish people. and when you it's amazing, really, when you look back on it. But everybody, you know, it was acceptable.
Yeah, yeah. So now, when you talk about running into your little escapade there, when you ran into Myra Hindley and Ian Brady, now before we get into that, was this kind of a common thing that you could be invited for food or different things? Like, this was sort of it wasn't really unusual for you?
It wasn't unusual for me at all, or my brothers and sisters out. I mean, basically, what we used to do, or what we would have done, we would have gone to one of the Catholic convents, and we'd bang on the door there, and it was always, is there any food after meals, sister? And depending on who was on and what mood she was in, she would go either slam the door and put it in your face, or she would go and find something, slops or whatever leftovers there were, and it would be thrown together in a big metal tin, cooking tin, and then we would take that and go across to the park, and you know, we would eat it. And when I say we, I'm talking about six or seven of the youngest. We would be there scoffing all that down, and then we would bring the empty pan back, lick clean, by the way. You know, there wouldn't be a pan in there. And we'd bring that back to the convent, because we'd know if we did, we wouldn't get anything else. But invariably, sometimes we would be told to clear off. I mean, we had one Mother Superior, an Irish woman, telling us, you know, that us Irish tinkers should get back to our own country. this is from an Irish Mother Superior, whatever she was, telling us those Irish thinkers should get back to our own country, tell our fathers to go and get a job, and then we wouldn't have to be begging on the streets. And she would just slam the door in our faces. But yes, invariably, this is what we done. We had to beg off the streets. And now and again, we would knock on somebody's door and ask for a drink of water. And you would always get somebody who'd say, look, come in, you know, and have some biscuits or, you know, whatever. And sometimes people would put beans and toast for us and, you know, anything just to give us something to eat. I mean, there was really, really so many kind people out there. And luckily there were, because that's how we survived out, you know, because of the people.
I was going to when you met Hindley, like she invited you back, and you guys ended up going back to their place. Now, you ended up leaving kind of scared. I'm just wondering, now, did you ever have any other people or that kind of experience with others that had invited you?
No, not really. I mean, the only other experience, a bit of a weird experience we had, was myself, Martin, my brother, and my sister Nancy. And we knocked on a house, and a woman came to the door, an oldish woman, and she invited us in. And all around the place was all lighters. Her husband collected lighters. And she says, you know, she wanted us to have a bath, and we all jumped into the bath together. She brought a towel in and dried us off and whatever, nothing untoward at all. Back on with our dirty, mucky clothes again, and they made us, I can always remember, sausage, egg, and chips and beans. And we scoffed all that down us. And then she, the only thing she asked when we were leaving was, could she just pat our pockets so that we hadn't stolen anything? And we were quite aghast by this. I mean, we let do it, but we would never have dreamed of stealing anything from somebody like that who's just begging, you know.
Yeah.
And I know that people, look and go, hang on a minute, you stole from other people. But the fact is, I only stole, I didn't steal. I would just open up a door for my father to come in. I stole from shops. I stole from big supermarkets. These people could afford to lose a bit of food because half the time they would throw the food out the back anyway. You know, so, you know, we would never have taken anything from people, et cetera. So that was about the only weirdest thing that I had. Most people were very, very kind to us. But having said that as well, Al, we would probably have gone back if it had been a woman on her own and a man, but we would never have gone back with a man on his own. For the simple reason, they were the strangers that we were taught, don't speak to strange men. Don't accept sweets from strange men. Strange men can be horrible. Strange men can do horrible things to you. What those horrible things were, we don't know. Sweets didn't sound very horrible, but, you know, it's how you perceive everything, or how adults perceive it, and they would teach us not to speak to strange men. So when I... Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, so Myra Hindley, she didn't really, when she first talked to you and all that, you didn't get... you didn't think she was anything different or weird.
She seemed just like one of the ordinary nice people that you see, you know, that would approach you and, you're all right, kid, you're all right, lad. Just that sort of nice person. You know, she seemed sort of fine when I was talking to her. I mean, I was sitting on the swing, and as she came over to me, I slowed the swing down. I let it slow on its own momentum. And I looked at her. Don't forget, I mean, I was a bit of a cheeky little sod at the time, you know. So, and I wasn't scared of anything or anybody. Nothing scared me, you know.
Right.
And, you know, don't forget, we were children, 7 years of age, out the streets at night till perhaps 2 o'clock in the morning. And we come across all sorts of people. But we were streetwise. We were able to read people. One of the good things, one of the reasons why with Myra Hindley as well is that I should point out, as streetwise kids, when one of the things we used to do, begging, is we'd have a penny. We'd start off with a penny, each one of us, and then we'd ask a stranger walking past, excuse me, do you have 2 halfpennies for a penny? Now, they would feel in the pockets and take out and give you the 2 halfpennies, half pennies. Most of them wouldn't take the penny. But a lot of them did take the penny, tight-ass kids. But a lot of them, I know you're not going to put that, but a lot of them did take the penny. A lot of them wouldn't take the penny. And so you could tell, you learn over a certain amount of time by looking at people's eyes, whether they're going to walk past you, whether they're going to give you a clip around the ear and tell you to F off, or whether they're going to stop and do the change, and whether they're going to not take it. You just knew. And so with Myra Hindley, her eyes, she just looked like an ordinary, everyday young lady, if you like, that was interested in me. And she came over and she had it there. And I didn't find anything untoward about her. She was quite shy, actually, quite coy.
One thing that's probably confusing for Americans and Canadians would be, when you guys were walking back to her place, she wanted you to walk separately and kind of pretend you didn't know each other. Why would that be?
Well, this is, well, I can only gather now. I mean, at the time, for me, it was, I could see her point, because we were always warned not to be with strangers. And I can remember when Myra Hindley was talking to me and she asked me, was I hungry? And she basically answered the question for me. I didn't even say yes. You know, she said, you look hungry. And that's when I said, yeah. Because she'd asked the question and answered it herself, you know.
Yeah.
Or answered it for me. And then I went to hold her hand. she held the metal chain in the swing. I got off the swing. I went, lifted my hand up to hold her hand, and she sort of pushed her hands into her pockets and started to walk away. And she says to me, "Well, don't walk with us. Follow me, because you mustn't be seen. You mustn't let other people see you, because you'll get into trouble." And I just took that is that if I'm seen with a stranger, I'm in for it, because it's what that's what I've always been told. And so that's how she got me to follow her. She walked about, I don't know, 6 or 7 yards, perhaps 10 yards away from me, and then she just looked over her shoulder and says, "Come on." And so I followed her.
It's kind of you were lucky. You changed your mind when you got there. So when you get into the house, what was your feeling of Ian Brady himself?
Well, prior to that, Ian Brady disappeared, because as I was walking and following Myra Hindley, Ian Brady then, I mean, I didn't know the names, by the way, so I mean, which, you know, at that moment in time, but Ian Brady, he started following behind, and he was about 15 yards behind or something like that. And that pace, that gap between all of us was kept. Hindley would look around now and again to make sure that I was in sight. And then at one stage in the book, he disappears, Brady. I don't mean by magic either. He wasn't there anymore. So he's obviously taken a completely different route. That didn't mean anything to me, because he could have gone into that pub that we just walked past or whatever. But once we got to the house, and she called me from the alleyway, because we walked down some alleyways and some alleys, if you like, or alleyways. Some are just small crossover alleyways where you cross from one street into the next street. And then some alleyways follow all the way down that road. Some are long, some are quite wide and short, which are the ones that cross over the street. So we'd actually gone down an alleyway from one street into where they lived.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And she was at the door as I got to the end of that short alleyway, and I was watching her, and she opened the door and beckoned me to come on. And as I got to the door, Brady just suddenly appeared. He must have been in that area, perhaps he just walked from around the corner. But he was there, hand on my shoulder. No push, no nothing. Just a gentle guide guiding me in, and I followed Hindley in. And I looked up into Brady's eyes as he closed the door, and he just looked at me. He wasn't smiling, he wasn't doing anything really. He just seemed like an ordinary person. I didn't really take much notice of him. And followed her into the back room, where he disappeared into the kitchen. He took his coat off and went into the kitchen. I mean, basically, we were inside the house. I'm in the living room, and it is a bit of a dump, actually, to be quite honest. I was surprised of how old it looks, considering they were quite a young couple. Quite smartly dressed as well. So I was a bit surprised. I was looking around the place. I mean, it was a lot better than the place that we lived in, I mean, I must admit, and had quite a lot of interesting things in there. But she took her clothes off, took a scarf and whatever. It was a black scarf, and this is one of the things that have always got to me. She had this long, very long black scarf, very thin, it could have been silk, black scarf. And she folded that once and then twice and then put that over the back of the chair. And she went into the kitchen. And there was a bit of chatting going on in there. I couldn't understand what they were saying because it was quite mumbles. And she came out, and it's the way that she pushed this plate down onto me. She had a thick slice of bread. It was uncut bread, so she'd obviously cut the bread. It was thick with jam. And she sort of, it was just the way that she dropped it down onto the table. Hurry up and get that down. Yeah. And that's when I looked up at her. Because it was just that, and I looked up at her, and I saw a complete different change in her eyes. Just completely different. I don't know what it was, but there was just a completely different change in her eyes, her looks. I don't know whether it was nerves. I just don't know, but it was completely different. And although it didn't worry me too much, the thing that did worry me the most, or the thing that got me the most, was I looked down at the bread and jam, and for the life of me, I looked and saw that there was no margarine on the bread. It was just the bread and jam. And don't ask me why that was, because I would have eaten anything, but it was just that. It was, well, there's no margarine on it. And I don't know, just things were happening then. Things just didn't seem right. She seemed a bit, I don't know, nervous. I mean, remember, she sort of put one hand down onto her other hand, like holding it, and walked away from me. She came back, I remember, with a tumblerful of sherry. Now, why did I know it was sherry? I could smell it. It stunk. And she put it down at the side. She'd gone upstairs. I heard her go up the stairs, and then she came back down within about 2 minutes, picked the sherry back up again and asked me what was wrong, and I asked if I could have a glass of water. And she went into the kitchen. Now, the sherry, the reason, what was starting to put me off now is my parents drank sherry, and it was cheap stuff, and you could smell it. And they got drunk on it, and we got beat on it. you know, it was this is the thing that always started him off before he went out. So I'm not very comfortable with drinks being around him and that smell. And then I heard a conversation going on. Again, I can't understand anything. I'm not even trying to really listen. But I heard him shout, "Fucking wait."
Oh, my.
That's what that you snap at her.
Oh, my.
Wait.
Yeah.
And straight away, that is my mother. That is my father. Drink. Arguing. I'm going to get her. I've got to get out of here. I need to go. And that's the reason why. The window was right next to me. And that's the reason why I went for the window. And not the door. Just straight for the window. The thing that frightened me the most, as I opened the window, it was stuck. It opened to about 3 or 4 inches and stuck. And the first thing I'm thinking is it's the same as what my father had done to our windows. He put wooden blocks on the sash windows so you can only open up to a certain height so nobody can get in. Or perhaps it was to keep us in, I don't know. You know, but nobody could get in. None of us could get out unless we went out the door. But that's what I'm thinking. And I'm just, for the life of me, I feel ill. I'm shaking. I'm terrified. Not because of them, because I can't get out. I'm stuck in here and I want to go. And I'll just keep pulling at the window and suddenly the whole lot just shut up. I heard this noise. And what it was one of the weights on the side of the sash must have got stuck. And it suddenly dropped. And the window shut up. And I just shut out the window. And that's when Myra Hinley grabbed hold of the back of my heel. I heard her shouting, "The little sh-.
Oh, my."
And she grabbed the back of my heel. But my momentum just kept me going. I was gone before she could even get a good grip on me. I was over that wall. And like a ferret, I was gone. You know.
Hmm. Did they chase you much down the road? Or?
Well, I don't know what happens. I remember being so scared. I didn't run down the road, actually. I ran through, I squeezed through an old... it was old, like Victoria fencing, and there was wasteland on the other side of this alleyway. So I squeezed through that and just carried on running. And then I came back a couple of roads away through quite a big gap. I could hear some people coming along, and so I ran in between two houses where there was an empty house that had just been knocked down. There was a pile of debris there, and there was also a green door, the outside toilet door, and I just crawled in and hid up underneath that, and somebody came across there. I could hear some footsteps coming across there, and I saw a pair of shoes standing right next to where I was up underneath, and then somebody started peeing. Some of it did splash on me. And I can remember them dropping a cigarette, and they were weeing on that. And then the feet went. I waited for, I don't know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And then I was up, gone. And I carried on begging on the streets. And I came home. I think I made about 8 pence when I got home. It was something like that. And I gave it to my sister, who was quite angry. Because we'd always promised that we'd always stay together with... this is my sister Maggie. But we promised that we'd stay together, Frank and myself. So she was angry that we didn't keep to that. But circumstances had it. As you know in the book, that we got separated. But that was it.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened if you would have stayed? If you would have been one of the victims?
I certainly know what would have happened. Not physically. I don't know whether I would have been tortured or sexually abused, but I think that's what would have happened. But I know that day when I followed Mary Hinley to her home, I was actually following her to my own death. And I think that's what scares me so much. Well, I wouldn't say scares me, but it does give me nightmares. And I do reflect back on that. And there are certain times when it could be a smell of a fire outside. It could be anything. It's just a certain thing. So it just takes me back. I just go back to it. And it's quite scary, you know, to think these things. It is really, really frightening. You know, so especially, you know, when I've read and I understand what happens to these other children. I mean, I am friends with Terry West. It was his sister that was one of the victims, and also Terry Kilbride, which John, because it was John Kilbride. John Kilbride was taken a week after I actually got away from these people in November. And so that's... Sometimes, you know, I feel guilty. You know, I feel, God, you know, would he have died if I... Would he have been killed if I had been killed? Would that satisfy him for that moment in time? I just don't know. But it's a horrible situation to have to go through in your own head and think of this, because there has been quite a lot of guilt there, you know, because of John Kilbride. I'm told by many people, and I'm sure they're right. You know, look, it happened, and that's how it's happened. You survive. Mm.
Right? Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Did you ever try to make contact with either one of them before they died in prison?
Oh yes, I was talking to some friends of mine here. We were having a Christmas party, and one of my friends was a junior lawyer at the time. There was the other one who was the lawyer. And we were chatting about things, and they were coming out with stories. Every year we tell jokes and tell each other stories and whatever. And I came out, it was my turn to tell a story. Normally I'll tell a joke, an Irish joke or whatever. And I decided this time that I'd tell them about my meeting with encounter with my him named Brady, because this was the part now that I'm going to start writing the books and whatever. And so I just wanted to see what the reaction was. And so I told them the story, going into a bit more detail than what I have to you, but it's there in the book. Anyway, by the way, the book's called 1963, A Slice of Bread and Jam, Al. Not A Slice of Bread and Jam. You were nearly there. But, yeah. But, you know, and obviously the slice of bread and jam is that bread and jam that was put down on the table for me. But we were talking, and I told them the story, and then I finished. And you could have heard a pin drop. And they were waiting for the pun. They were waiting for the one-liner. And nothing came. And then they were like, what? Have you been serious about this? And I said, yeah, I've been serious about it. And of course, then we started discussing my life. And God, what led up to this? Blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. And then this journalist turned around to me and says, you ought to lie to him. Tell him. Tell him you're still alive. Tell him that you know what you've done. And I said, it's stupid. You won't get an answer from him. He said, well, probably not. But I did anyway. A few weeks later, I wrote a letter to him. That was in 2000. And within a matter of a week, I had a letter come back to me. I don't know whether it went to the wrong address, but it was an old man that bought it. And he says, oh, he says, there's a letter here for you. And I took it from him. And I think he lived across one of the other streets. And I opened it, and I was gobsmacked. It had been sellotaped at the back. And there was a long slip on there informing me that the letter had been opened by the hospital. It was signed by Ian Brady, the actual back of the envelope where the sellotape was. So perhaps he'd done that so that I would know if it's been opened or not. But it was opened. And Ian Brady just says, dear Mr. Ratty, and I remember the letter off by heart. I don't even get it out of the drawer. You are very much mistaken in your belief that you had an encounter with me. There are lots of people, or there are a number of people who think the same thing. But then, back to the end of that bit, he goes on to complain about Myra Hindley and about her saying this and whatever the thing is that she says, but, you know, the people will find out what she is really all about. But the curious thing that he says is, in all the places that we've traveled to, the people that we've met, not one of them had noticed, or if he did, not cared to mention, that we were ordinary people and not dripping blood. And that really shook me. It shook me to the core. I felt so cold when I read those words, because he was goading me. He was goading me. He was goading everybody, because what he was saying to me was, that's the reason why it was so easy to get kids like him, because we look so ordinary. We didn't look like monsters. And it was really, really scary. And I've had a few people, psychiatrists, if you like, look at the letter, and it says exactly the same thing. He's golden there. It's a goat. And that's what he's saying. You know.
Yeah, just amazing. So now you've, have you written all three books now, or is there just two out right now?
No. I've written a second book. The first book is called 1963, A Slice of Bread and Jam. That dealt with my life at 7 years of age, right up to the age of nine. At 9 years of age, I was put into care. My parents had cleared off. We didn't see them. They never came back to us. And there was only me and my brother, Marston, left. We were left at that house all on our own, trying to survive on our own. Me at seven, him at eight. And so we gave ourselves up to the police. And we got a nice meal out of it as well. And we were put into the care of the local authorities, which was the Manchester authorities. And we were separated. We were apparently told that we were not good for each other. He went into one home, and I went to an approved school called St. Vincent's Approved School, which was run by a Catholic charity, nuns. Prior to that, it used to be a lunatic asylum. And believe me, Al, I think the nuns were the lunatics that were still there from that era, because they were just absolutely mad. It was mass. That's all it was. Religion. Nothing else. And we were knocked around. I spent, I think, roughly around about 3 years of being sexually abused by one particular person. He groomed me, sexually abused me. I fell for it, and I went to him, and I did what he wanted me to do for him, because that was love. I'd never had my parents put their arms around me and give me any love. But he put his arms around me and gave me love. He gave me more than love. And that completely, you know, at the time it was going on, that for me, you know, that was acceptable, because I needed to be loved. I wanted to be loved. And he played on that. That's what happened. But we were living in a regime of the violence from the staff, and then the violence and the sexual encounters and sexual abuse from a regime of our own peers. I'm 9 years of age, but there's 14-year-old kids there as well, just coming into puberty, and they're abusing anybody. All the weak kids get abused. And I learned to look after myself eventually. You know, I wouldn't let this man abuse me anymore, and I wouldn't let anybody else abuse me anymore. But it took its toll. It took a toll on my life. And at the age of 15 years of age, when I was released from there, I'd gone into foster parents, and I took their tablets. I took a massive overdose. I lost a complete week of time. I didn't know what had happened. Obviously, they didn't want me there, because I was a big risk to them, and they didn't want that. And so that was my life. I was under the social services, in and out of other children's homes, and then at 15 years of age, I was basically out in the streets. Although I was still in care, I was out on my own. They found me a flat, found me a little job. I think I was on 50 pence an hour, which was £4 a week, or, yeah, £4 a week, £4 a day, sorry. And I had to survive on that, pay rent, and the social services, I never saw them again. They never gave me any funds or anything like that, and I just went on through life. I think it was about 7, perhaps 8 genuine suicide attempts. The last one being jumping over a cliff in front of my own son. Ambulance, police, helicopter out looking for me. And, you know, I jumped off an 80-foot cliff, Al, and I slid down on my back. How could I slide down on my back? I can't fathom it out. And I ended up on a little ledge, about 2 foot by 2 foot, about 20 foot off the ground, concrete at the bottom. And all the only injuries I had, the only injuries was my back. But I'd scratched it coming down on the tall part of it. And so I do believe that, you know, I had a guardian angel then, I had a guardian angel at the time of the meeting with Deep End too. And, yeah. But I'm happy to say, writing these books and looking at my story has been an eye-opener for me, because now I'm seeing it for myself. And anybody who suffers from mental health issues, if they can sit down and write about what they're feeling to themselves and be honest with themselves, it's a help. It does help. And that's what I've done, Al. You know, the humour lightens the load. You know, on the second book, I've had mental health, people who work in mental health, people, readers who have looking after care for children and foster children, have contacted me, wrote letters to me, and says, not only, you know, was it a brutal, honest book and funny at the time, that opened their eyes up to how people, children like me, when I was a child, tick.
And it's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, it just gave them another perception to look at and see how people tick. And I would recommend writing to anybody. I would recommend sitting down and writing what they are thinking, what's hurting them. And just open up to yourself. Be honest with yourself. And it just all comes out. You know, and I'm very, very fortunate. You know, I'm very fortunate. I had a fantastic publishers in this country, Trinity Mirror, which is a big newspaper company over here. What I'm hoping for now, and I hope it will be, you know, put this out, I'm hoping for an American publisher to contact my publishers, because we're looking for overseas.
Well, contact. Let's hope that we've got a publisher listening that wants to do it.
Yeah, that would be good. Can I just say? Can I just say something else? Can I just say hello to Mary Blue and also Joe Gardner? They are members of the team that work and produce and get together every single year in Minnesota. They put on a concert for the 9/11 first responders and those people that perished. And they also have one of my songs that they use. I wrote a song for them. It's was written and scored for a full orchestra and 60-strong choir, and they perform that every single year. And they're also looking for somebody, a celeb, that would come along and sing the song for them. So all these thousands of people that turn up just to, for one night only, once a year, to remember the first responders of 9/11 and those people that didn't make it out of there. You know, and I think it's a fantastic thing that they do. I think that they're the only people in the any of the states that actually put that on every single year. So if there's, you know, a celeb out there or somebody who knows a celeb who wants to come out, opera, it doesn't matter. They can sing it any way they want, but it's an absolutely beautiful song called Beating Hearts. If there's anybody there out, you know, well, get in touch with you, and you can get in touch with me, and I can put it over to Mary, Blue, and Joe out in America.
Well, let's hope for that one, too. And again, you know, our guest has been Tommy Radigan, and we have the books up online. And thank you for taking the time.
No, it's a pleasure, and I wish everybody, you know, good health, and get those books, read them, and come on this journey with me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.